the ticking time bomb of tension, which could explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge.
This world would be a pretty easy and fun place to live if everybody just minded their own business.
Diffuse the ticking time bomb of tension.
Get us into the boss, they scream, without a throat, without a lung.
Good evening, everyone. My name's David Condon. Welcome to Inside Track. It's Thursday the 22nd. And it just so happens to be the 22nd show. If you've not heard the show before, we discuss basically current affairs and political news stuff. So if you'd like to get in touch, you can contact us via Inside Track on Twitter, @InsideTrackDJ. Or you can go and visit our website, which is bookarmor.com, spelt the American way, which is bookarmor.com. More than welcome to join us. And I would like now to introduce Jay. Hello, Jay, all the way from Taiwan. Hello.
Hello, Dave. Hello, everyone.
How's it going?
Everything's good, I believe.
Are you sure about that? Everything?
It could be a little cooler.
How hot is it?
Well, I've been watching on Facebook as the UK friends of mine lament the hot weather, and they're putting pictures of their thermometers and their thermostats, and they say things like 29.2 or 30.1.
As I did to you the other day.
Yeah, and today here, this was not the hot summer day. This was just recovering from the torrential rain last week. You may remember we had a meter of rain each day for about 6 days, and now it was 33 degrees C today.
That's pretty hot. Unpleasantly hot, I would suggest.
Well, my firm belief as an Englishman is that anything over 28 degrees is basically torture.
Yeah, I feel the same way, but it doesn't even have to be that high. It's more like 15 or 16.
Well, you're in Rochdale, so anything above, zero.
So how's your week been? Okay.
My week is, now I can venture out again after the deluge, just been more of the same. For those who don't listen to the show, I teach English to school children here in Taiwan, a kind of after-school study club. And we're just winding up the semester, so some of the students are graduating from their schools. Now, in England, when I was a child, you didn't really graduate, did you? They did nothing when you left school. The rite of passage was, at my school, was burning your tie and your blazer and your shirt outside the gates and tearing all your books to pieces. But these days, it's become an American thing, hasn't it? They've imported it that they have proms and graduation parties from kindergarten upwards, it seems. And Taiwan follows the American system. So some of my students graduated from their elementary school, their primary school, this week. So I was kind of touched that some of them asked me to sign their graduation books, just wishing them all the best for the future.
See, what I remember of my last day of school was that loads of people basically had flour and eggs, and signing people's shirts was generally the thing that I remember about my last day of school.
Oh, yeah, the popular kids at my school did that, but no one wanted to sign my shirt. They certainly wanted to throw eggs and flour at me, though, so I just ran home quickly.
Well, there you go. Happy days. So, the first topic up for discussion today is the Grenfell Tower fire, which we covered last week. It's still in the news, still going, and further developments. There's been some interesting stuff. I saw Theresa May this morning in the House of Commons, and she was asked on several occasions if it was the cladding that was responsible for the kind of fueling the fire. And it seems that the police are going to release a statement within the next 48 hours. And it's already come out that, and this is a ridiculously low number considering there's supposed to be something like 4,000 of these properties with this cladding on it, possibly. Well, they found three so far are confirmed to have the same cladding. And so she's advised all the landlords to do checks, do tests, because they can get the hours, they can get the result in a few hours. So, yeah, did you come across this at all this morning?
Well, what I saw was that I saw a different number. I did see what you said. How many thousands did you say? Was it 4,000?
Yeah, it's an odd number, so just over 4,000.
I'm kind of amazed by that. It probably shows that I did live most of my life in small towns and villages in the UK. I was trying to imagine 4,000 tower blocks. I've hardly seen any in my life in England, but I'm assured that they're there. The number I saw was something like they're doing checks on something like 600 of these that they think may be at risk of having this cladding on them. So that was the number I saw. But as you said, three... it's kind of suggests they haven't looked very hard if they've only found three so far.
So there's an awful lot that's come out about this, some of the horrific things people were seeing, eyewitness accounts. There was an interesting, I think you might have sent it to me actually, Jay, the James O'Brien, where he's come across a letter that from the head of the Kensington Council, Piggott Brown, is it? Nicholas Piggott Brown, something like that. Offering £100 to rich residents because they've managed to, manage their finances as a council so well that they could afford to give the £100 per person back to the rich. And this would have coincided with exactly the same time that they were scrimping and saving on the refurb of Grenfell Tower.
Yes, it's quite a well-known phenomenon, isn't it, that if you're not well off, the further you are down in the social order, the relatively more expensive everything becomes. So, for example, I think, well, both yourself and myself as students have experience of the key meter phenomenon,
yeah.
Where it seems to use an incredibly large amount of money. When you've only got perhaps a few people living in a house, it's not as if students have that many showers and baths. I know I didn't when I was at university. But because you can't afford to pay monthly or actually sometimes you can ask them to allow you to have a kind of monthly bill and they simply don't trust you because you're students. So there is a kind of discrimination at work there. Also, you'll find that, for example, people on low incomes are often criticized for using taxes excessively. But actually, if you are poor, running a car is ridiculously expensive. And if you wish to go to like two or three locations in a day, it's not really a way to get there on the buses. So taxes aren't really a luxury when you don't have much money. They're kind of, you have to factor them in to what you're doing. And here, like you said, what it was, the way it was angled, was that if you could pay your, I believe it was council tax bill, if you could settle it all at once, you'd get a £100 rebate. So clearly, the people with the money will get the rebate. And then if you didn't have that money, well, then you have to pay the full amount.
Well, this is it. You get, if you live in a certain kind of, I don't know, wealth band, let's say, you can get access to subsidies and so on. So, yeah, the same old, same old. So let's get on and play a clip. This is an eyewitness. And she explains how amazingly a young child was thrown out of the 9th or 10th floor of the tower. And so, amazingly, some guy caught the baby that was wrapped up. Let's have a listen.
From the left and from the right and from the above, it just spread so rapidly. And then you couldn't help but notice people frantically banging on the windows. And then at one point during those few minutes, a lady appeared at the window, gesturing, body language, from what she was saying, "I'm about to throw my baby, please catch the baby." And the baby, I think, was wrapped in some sort of bedsheet blanket, and she threw the baby as the baby came down. And this was about approximately from the 9th or 10th floor. A member of the public, a gentleman, ran forward and miraculously grabbed the baby. And like I said, above you, from the left, from the right, mostly kids, it was harrowing torturing screams for help, young kids, and I could also, where the fire was now spreading, people were reaching out from the front window, trying to grasp a bit of fresh air, trying to breathe. It looked like they were struggling. And there were, at one point, one window, about four or five heads all squeezing their heads through. It was honestly like a horror movie unfolding in front of us.
Sounds absolutely traumatic, doesn't it?
Yeah, I do believe the gentleman that caught the baby has now come forward to the newspapers.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Mr. Ian Botham.
Right, not the Ian Botham.
Well, believe me, I think that's the only person who could catch a baby thrown from 9 or 10 floors. That's astonishing, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's just... So, before we continue debating this, I just want to play another clip. I won't play all of it because it's about 3 minutes, but I'll play about a minute or so. But again, this is another eyewitness.
I was here since the blaze happened, and I was on the Hurstway Walk. And I literally seen on the side of the fire, on the side of the building was burning. And I told, there was only few police officers. Don't get me wrong, I don't have problems with police officers. Only few police officers were there. And 40 minutes later came police officers more. Okay? Let me get that straight. I don't know about the building. I don't know nobody from that block. Maybe a friend of friend. I know my son's friends, they're all dead. So I don't have personally contact that I know. I don't have a problem with the structure of the building. I don't know about that. But I'm talking about what I was there yesterday and what I seen. I was there on the bridge. I was there right next to the building. I told people to get off, to jump, to put the kids on, to throw the kids. Wanted to get mattresses, wanted to get sheets. Police were pushing us away. Fathers was coming from the prayer. So they had to see literally their children and their wives on the window. Hopeless, can't do anything. And we're like, well, it's burning on the side and it's just starting. Let's get the people off all that side of the building. The police was like, no, go away. We're dealing with this. Go. They pushed us literally from the bridge all the way down. We run around to the car wash and we've seen the fire it coming upwards and then gradually going on the roof. By then, it's still, there were more time that people could get off. But the police officers and the parents on the telephone, they've been told, stay in your property.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't come down.
That's all we can hear.
It's dangerous.
From outside.
Yeah. Sorry, it was not dangerous. I have footages and my iPhone does not lie about the timing. They had time to escape, but they were on the window screaming and shouting. When it got so, the fire happened from the outside in. Didn't happen from the inside out. It started from the outside in. They had plenty of time. Let me tell you, the fireman came 2 hours later. Okay? Couldn't even park their car anyway to get access through. So they came all the way to Hurstway Walk, put their car there, and then they took the water out. By the time they did that, it was 4:25, and I had them recorded.
So, yeah. She goes on to say, actually, later on in that clip, when she says about at the time they were given out 17 people had perished in the fire, of course most people would know that that's nonsense. And what was the name of it? The technique they're employing by releasing slowly the numbers that have died.
Well, what's usually used for this when the government wants to just kind of, they'll allow a little of the truth out, but they'll conceal the rest. And they'll drip feed the media to try and string things out. And it's often referred to as a limited hangout, the operation. So first, the number is injected there, 17. As you said, it was always going to be a lot more than that. But what you see is they start you off at 17 and kind of warm you up as an audience. And then they slowly start to increase it. So they've been incrementing it by, what was it? It seemed like 10 or 15 a day. Steadily.
Yeah.
They could not come out at the beginning and just say. Now, of course, they must have, after a few days at least, within perhaps 36 hours, they must have had a fairly comprehensive list of all the unaccounted people.
I would have thought so.
Just from, for example, the children must be registered at schools in the area, and it's not a wealthy tower block. So the children at that school are probably all going to fairly local schools. They're not going off to these selective schools on the other side of London. They're not going anywhere posh, are they? Also, medical records. They could have consulted hospitals or NHS practices. If some of them are from overseas, or perhaps asylum seekers or refugees, these kinds of individuals, well, those are usually tracked as well. So I'm not so sure. You know, what's happening is, if you noticed, the death toll was going up, but without saying that they'd found the bodies of particular individuals. It was just increasing on its own without actually discovering bodies. So they could have just told you how many people were actually registered missing and let you work it out from there. I did do a little research into how many people potentially may have been living in that building. Now, there were 10 floors where there were many, many unaccounted people. And they're the floors from 14 to 23. Now, the woman in your clip there was kind of suggesting that many of the individuals on those floors might have been able to escape if they hadn't been told to stay in place.
Yeah.
So they could have perhaps been saved. I'd struggle with the idea that they were being told to stay in there because there was some malicious intent on behalf of the police officer.
That was to do with the policy. That was That's the policy. When a fire breaks out, you stay put. Allegedly, the reasoning behind that was to do with the fact that the fireproofing within the premises would have been able to protect you for up to an hour.
Well, that does kind of fit with the scenario that didn't transpire, because the cladding spread the flames so quickly that idea that fire doors would necessarily be any use. They're not going to be any use, are they? If it's the cladding, I believe, was covering so much of the building that it would have just spread its smoke throughout the building. So the fire doors wouldn't have been any use. So, no, I don't think there's any malicious intent there. But, of course, what happened was, in a sort of grim irony, the policies they developed didn't fit with that kind of blaze. So if we look in this thing, that said there were 10 floors where most of the unaccounted people are from, and the building had 127 flats. So it's kind of 6 flats on each floor. So yeah. If there's 10 floors, it's 60 flats. So you decide how many people you think may have been in each flat. It seems like many of the rooms might have been subcontracted, or people were living there kind of as friends off the books,
Which
is quite common in London. What would you suggest if we just said there were 4 people in each flat?
Yeah. I mean, you could take just your average family size, isn't it, really?
So then we'd have 240 we'd be talking about.
Yeah. Well, what was fascinating is that Lily Allen has come out with some interesting stuff. And there was an eyewitness account of a chap saying that 42 bodies were found in one room and they all huddled together trying to escape the flames. Now, I came up with... I was thinking about this the other day, and especially when you saw the first parts of the fire taking hold and it seemed to shoot up along a particular line of the building. It turns out it followed the gas routes that were going up on the outside of the building. And then someone had taken a photograph in the middle of the block of flats in the stairwell, where you would basically use to escape in case of a fire. Well, they'd actually installed gas pipes in there. So just imagine, right, if the gas supply that's going up the side of the apartment is alight, that fire will then be making its way through the pipe system and will probably break its way out around your cooking area. And then you run out of the flat to see what's going on, and then there's fire in the middle of the premises because there's gas pipes going up through the central column, which is your escape route. I mean, that is just absolute lunacy.
Yeah, so that's where the kind of the political dimension comes in, is are these people being placed in such hazardous conditions and expected to live there simply because they're basically not very wealthy?
Yeah, right. So let's play the clip of the guy saying about the 42 bodies.
You know what? How about a friend who works for the fire brigade here in Lavender Grove, yeah? Yesterday on the phone, he said they found about 42 bodies in one room, all hiding together. No one knows that. It's only because we know the brother, he's a fireman, that he told us this.
But he can't tell you.
He can't tell you. He can't come out and tell you like that. So he can't come out because he'll probably get the sack or something. Yeah. But they said they found 42 bodies in one room, bro.
That's Imagine if you're a fireman and you walk in and see that, women and children, all sorts.
Well, there was quite a compelling account in The Independent. I don't know if you've read that, by one of the firefighters describing his experience up on floor number 20 and 21. I will put that up on Book Armour. But he was saying there, you know, the firefighter's dilemma. He rescued two people on coming down from floor 21, and they told him there were five more people up on the next floor. But they were in a panic state, of course. And then he said he's got the thing running through his head about, you know, am I doing enough? Do I have enough air to go up there? You know, have I lost my rhythm stopping to deal with these two people? He describes his thought processes for you. And as I say, very compelling. I'm sure in the months and weeks and months to come, the firefighters will remain heroes for what they did on this occasion. But we're also going to see, as you suggest, there's going to be a considerable psychological fallout from this particular incident for both the members of the public involved and the firefighters and the emergency services who are involved too. It's truly a terrible event.
Yeah. So this is Lily Allen. She talks about reality.
But first of all, if we're talking about reality into these people's lives, I think that what people would really like is a more honest count of how many people have actually died in this event, how many people have been killed. And, you know, I think that the humanitarian effort on the ground here, the volunteering, which is being led by community leaders and volunteers, it's not being led by the council, it's being run by the people of this community. And it is chaotic. They don't have any experience with it. And I think that it's actually playing into the hands of the government, because once these people's hope turns to anger, they've got a real problem on their hands. And that is what I feel like the government are trying to micromanage people's grieving here. That's what's happening. I've never in my entire life seen an event like this where the death count has been downplayed by the mainstream media. 17, I'm sorry, but I'm hearing from people that the figure is much closer to 150, and that many of those people are children.
So, yeah, and just as she gets to that, Jon Snow, this was on Channel 4 News, he has to kind of tail off the interview shortly after she says that. But just before she finishes it, she does make a valid point when it comes to this.
But these are families, and when you have to identify a body, you report as the next of kin. There are no next
Lily
of kin.
Lily Allen, thank you very, very much for coming.
There you go. There's no next of kin because they all perished in the fire with them.
This is absolutely the case, isn't it? We're getting accounts. Daily Mail ran a story about some children who preferred to die with their family in the fire rather than seek safety. They'd just rather die together than leave your grandfather and your grandmother behind.
Yeah. Well, how would you possibly... I mean, guilt. So, I mean, you get survivor's guilt with situations like this, don't you? You hear about that all the time.
Yes, absolutely. Lily Allen's getting lots of criticism from the right, of course, for speaking out. The Daily Mail's got a picture of her house in the Cotswolds today, as if that truly has a bearing on it. The Daily Mail, for whatever reason, hates the idea that someone can have financial success or economic success and still care about other people. They just hate that idea. And truly, you know, they'll attack it every chance they get. Not a huge fan of Lily Allen, and I am aware of her. You know, I've met people who went to school with her, actually. She went to one of these independent schools. I think it was Beedale's.
Right.
But there, you have to take her at her word. And she's pointing in the right direction in terms of the fact that it's ludicrous, really, to suggest that only 17 people have been killed at that stage. But it's all about managing public anger. And in the wake of such large incidents, such large loss of life, where... there may have been negligence on the part of the people who are administering the building. What you'll tend to find, I watched the Hillsborough disaster live on television, and many, many parallels between that event and this one in terms of trying to tamp down public outrage. Now, one of the things they did with the Hillsborough disaster was they used the kind of partisan nature of football supporters to turn them against the victims by suggesting that the Liverpool fans had been involved in many kind of criminal and disgraceful activities regarding the dead that day. And those were the slurs that the people of Liverpool have never forgotten or forgiven the tabloid newspapers for printing. And here, what you'll find in the same way as Hillsborough is that the police will become involved, but there's two strands. the first strand will be this criminal investigation that's going on. So that may be a perfectly legitimate investigation. It will be long drawn out, no doubt, because, as Craig Murray points out on his blog, the evil that is outsourcing makes the chain of responsibility extremely hard to clarify. Maybe all kinds of organizations, all kinds of, do they call them stakeholders?
Yeah, stakeholders.
At work in the maintenance of this block. So we may, a little like the Iraq War inquiry, it may be one of those things where we never actually find out who decided, who signed the piece of paper that said to use that cladding. An interesting thing has come out today, though. And before I go back to those parallels with Hillsborough and the public order, the second strand.
Okay.
The other thing that came out was that that council, that block was inspected by the council 16 times regarding the use of that cladding. And it did not fail any of those inspections, which suggests that the fire regulations did not actually work effectively in this case. So there's another kind of wrinkle that's coming out. It looks very much, doesn't it, as if it's one of these cases where it may be kind of corporate manslaughter or at the very least negligence at work.
I would have thought it was corporate manslaughter. That's
now
what I would have thought.
Now the second strand of the police work is to keep public order. So this was the in the Hillsborough disaster in its wake, the police worked very much with the right-wing media, with the tabloids, to redirect public anger in that case. And what you'll find here is that this is why the number of dead is being managed so carefully, because the important thing now on the from the Metropolitan Police's point of view is that this anger doesn't lead, as it well could, to a significant breach of public order. They don't want a repeat of the London riots by simply coming out and announcing cold that 300 people have died. So this is what it's all about. I'm sure by the end of this, the total will be in three figures, perhaps as many as 200 people. But they will make absolutely sure that we walk there very slowly.
Well, in the interview that I played from Lily Allen, she actually states that, you know, that the government and the council is going to have a real issue when people's grief turns to anger. Now, we saw this a few days ago when they decided, loads of protesters and people involved in the fire in the local area had gone to the local council offices to demand answers, and of course there was seemingly no one there. And the BBC and Sky had propagated the story as not grieving people wanting answers for why their people have been burned alive, but as in, like, some elite group of protesters had broken into the council properties and were causing trouble for no reason.
Oh, they'll be calling them professional agent provocateurs next.
Yeah, exactly.
A segment of the hard left.
Yeah.
Now, with reference to the hard left, though, the Morning Star, the communist newspaper, they did run a story by their guy, and he was pointing out that we should be informed whether any of the people who were inside the building and had been trying to draw attention to the safety issues, if the Metropolitan Police had listed any of them as domestic extremists. They suggested that should be clarified. And they also said that this Grenfell Action Group, which has been campaigning for years now to try and have the safety issues of this building addressed, we should also be informed if the police had infiltrated that organization and sought in any way to disrupt or discredit them. Worthwhile questions given the history of spy cops' involvement in sabotaging the search for social justice.
Yeah, so this is Philip Hammond, Chancellor. I think he went against the party line by saying this.
Well, again, my understanding is that the cladding in question, this flammable cladding,
yes,
which is banned in Europe and the US, is also banned here. That's my understanding.
So why did it go up?
Well, so the question, there are two separate questions. One is, are our regulations correct? Do they permit the right kind of materials and ban the wrong kind of materials? Second question is, were they correctly complied with? And obviously, that will be a subject that the inquiry will look at. It will also be a subject that the separate criminal investigation will be looking at.
So, yeah. Well, sorry, Dave.
I knew you were going to ask me my thoughts there.
Jumped in. Did you go for it?
Sure, I've got lots of energy today. I don't know why.
Must be the heat.
Maybe. But the thing there about Philip Hammond is his role, his job, is Chancellor of the Exchequer. But he's coming out there and he's speaking to the issue of whether or not this cladding had been legally applied to the building in question, which, as we can see, is far outside his remit. I would hate to accuse someone of playing politics, but I think, though he may well be a concerned onlooker with regards to this tragedy, we can't ignore the fact that Philip Hammond is also, along with Boris Johnson and Amber Rudd, one of the individuals in the frame to take over the leadership of the Tory party and potentially the country when Theresa May is pushed off the stage. So I think there's possibly a little bit of that in there. I'm not saying he doesn't really care, but there are other considerations at work. I think most of us would agree.
Yeah, yeah. So you brought up the idea that, you know, there may have been some police infiltration in this group, because this group had actually gone on record, the Tenancy Association group, would that be what it would come under?
I think it was called something just like an organisation of the residents, basically. Right. But as I said, it was known as Grenfell Action Group. As we did say on last week's aborted transmission, they had mentioned numerous times on their blog during the last 4 years that basically only the deaths of residents would bring any action on the part of the authorities. Tragically, you know, they were proved correct in that assessment. Their blog posts are still up there, while other parties involved in this disaster were busy scrubbing their websites of information in the wake of this. Some of the contractors were throwing everything down the memory hole as quickly as they could.
Yeah, who was the MP? Lammy?
David Lammy, yes.
He'd noticed that the various contractors had removed all their, you know, their glossy publications on their website, advertising the work, stellar work that they'd done on that particular building. And of course, within a couple of days of the fire, it had all disappeared. And he said, rightly, if they're removing posts on the internet, on their websites, then what else are they removing?
Yeah, that's a fair point there. And he did call for the Metropolitan Police to step in and make sure that, well, evidence wasn't destroyed, which is rather ironic, asking the Metropolitan Police, who are probably the world leaders in destroying evidence, along with the FBI and the CIA. So I did take that with a pinch of salt. If anyone wants to look up Operation Tiberius, you'll find out just how good the Met are at destroying evidence of their own crimes. I think they made an entire lorry's worth of evidence disappear there. But it does show David Lammy's got his thinking cap on. He did learn something at Harvard.
Do you think that will the government and the media go down the route, because there is a palatable anger in the air, do you think that they would actually go down that route to demonise certain parties within this tragedy?
I think it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult. I think what you'll find is, I'm about to do that most horrible of things, which is, bear with me, is to think like a police officer.
Well, I'm amazed you can do that, Jay.
Well, that's it. Let me just readjust myself. All right. Now, if you wish to maintain public order, then what the police will say is, who are the sources potentially of this public disorder? You know, who would be its agents? They're going to be looking at the people who have been involved in the activist group, at the best organized people, and many of these may actually have escaped from the fire, so they may be at the moment kind of temporarily homeless. Now, one thing we're already seeing is they're busily trying to disperse the newly homeless residents to the four winds, basically. So that will be one part of the strategy, is that just you'll disperse them throughout London. I think that'll be a key part of this. And then the other thing that they'll want to do is kind of, they'll look at all the sites that could act as a focal point for public anger. And they'll perhaps take some countermeasures there, And so, well, if not physical countermeasures, like placing some barriers there, they may have like a police presence there. They'll be also watching it that way. They may also be trying to gather intelligence in terms of what information may have been gathered from within the building by people as they fled. The 21st century being, in its nature these days, is that people may have had their cell phones on, their smartphones, and be filming on their way out. So maybe all kinds of information there that the police might want to look at in terms of being able to adjust, you know, the media operation. They'll be looking at all those things, you know, it'll be a multifaceted approach. But I think if you read the newspapers, you can certainly see that they're already dispersing the people affected, which was another thing when we saw in the aftermath of, for example, Hurricane Katrina, where these FEMA camps that sprang up with these terrible prefabricated housing for the newly displaced victims of Hurricane Katrina, they were literally in places like Idaho.
Yeah.
So you drop 1,000 New Orleans residents onto basically a resourceless trailer park in Idaho with no Wi-Fi signals in the middle of nowhere, and they're out of the game. London is a very big place, and there aren't that many victims. So I think most of the effort will be devoted to that.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it's absolutely... The more I look into this, it's just the more horrific it gets, you know, with the... some of the eyewitness accounts, it's quite disturbing. So, anything else you'd like to mention on this?
Well, the other part would be, will they engage in kind of demonising people in the press? Now, yeah. The Ethiopian gentleman whose fridge exploded was kind of named by the Daily Mail and his picture placed there. Whereas actually, when we move on to the Finsbury Park attack later, we'll see that they're busy taking out their pixelation pens. in that case, but this poor gentleman with his fridge that exploded, it's impossible to suggest that, well, although in Daily Mail logic land, they might be urging you to dislike this guy. You know, he traveled all the way from Ethiopia. I mean, how dare he? He came to the promised land that is Albion. How dare he? He bought food that he needed to keep cold. You know, you can already feel... You know, the Daily Mail readership rising up in anger there as one. You know, how dare he? And then he placed it inside a refrigerator. Well, of course, the refrigerator then exploded. So everything that follows is this poor gentleman's fault. No, that part will not necessarily work. I think they're kind of going to do a love bomb on the victims. So what we'll find is that one way to dampen out the anger is to point the camera at all the emotional scenes at the funerals, all the flowers. And keep the focus there. Yeah. Another part is to keep playing on the angle of the heroes and the emergency services. So there's plenty of other places to look, point the camera rather than allowing lots of angry voices to come on TV.
Yeah, there's an interesting clip with a woman who is basically an eyewitness. This is what she says.
Past the police, run to the tower block and started screaming at people and trying to help them. They ran into the building. If it wasn't for all these young Muslim boys round here helping us, coming from mosque, people would have dead. Enough more people would have dead. Enough more people. They want to talk about them when they do wrong and all these kind of things. When they're doing bad, when they're doing good, that they were the first people with bags of water giving to people, helping people, running and telling people.
From other parts of London, from all of London,
all of London, all over,
all of London, not just from our estate.
The whole of Latimer Road, down by Edward Woods, all over came out with water. We don't care what people are.
Yes, that kind of confirms what the. One of the earlier clips we played where the woman said that a load of the fathers had come out of the local mosque, saw what was going on, went steaming over to help and then got turned back by the police. So it seems that the local guys who were coming out of the mosque did their part to save quite a few lives, it seems, which is excellent, but it's not being propagated on the TV like that, is it?
No, they should give them their credit where credit is due.
Definitely.
I think one thing, these disasters all around the world, not just in the UK, we do sometimes, as nations, tend to pat ourselves on the back, the US being the worst offender, you know, oh, nowhere else in the world would anyone run into a burning building and save a little cat. I do it all over the world every day of the week, my American friend. What you find is that there might be a few Muppets out there who are responsible for some of these attacks, as we'll see later. But basically, you know, the world is full of heroes when push comes to shove. And we saw that again here. You know, all over the world, young men will risk their lives to save other people. That just seems to be, thankfully, one of these universal traits. If these, as she says, if people like to paint these people in this part of London as ne'er-do-wells or rascals or gangsters or worse,
hooligans,
then at least have the decency when they risk their own safety, their own lives, to go and save people in this way. People they might not even know. So what? No, you have to take your hat off to them, give them some credit.
See, when you say that, I always think of Bill Hicks when he says hooligans, ruffians.
Yeah, I've got many, many words to describe these ragamuffins. Keith Faz is the guy that likes the ragamuffins, isn't it? Better not touch on that.
Keith Faz.
Was it Keith Faz that sold the Ethiopian gentleman that fridge?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, he's better with washing machines.
What's the is that the same chap allegedly into poppers?
Well, he's the gentleman who can supply you with drugs if you come for a rent boy sex party with him, but apparently the police don't find that very compelling evidence of wish to supply an illegal substance, and it all got wished away, didn't it? He's still there on these various committees in the Houses of Parliament. Keith Faz is a disgrace by
But didn't he voted down to make that drug, it's known as a gay drug generally, and he voted it down because, you know, he's an avid enthusiast.
Actually, funnily enough, one section of the liberal left, the kind of the Guardian, they celebrated that. They said, well, that just shows that his votes in the House of Commons align with his private life, so they said that showed his integrity. this is a gentleman that pretends to be a washing machine salesman and hires I almost swore there. Love nest.
Oh, wow.
A brisk walk from his family home, and then engages in all kinds of strange liaisons with the rough trade that he solicits online. But apparently that vote and his private interest in poppers just demonstrates his enormous integrity.
Well, in the same light, it came to light that there was a bill being passed before the government where it said basically to at least bring in a standard of health and safety for landlords in order to look after their residents. And quite a few MPs voted against it. And what do we find out afterwards? Well, quite a lot of the Tory MPs, especially the ones who voted it down, are landlords. So they don't want to bring in legislation that's going to directly affect their income from all their properties that they have.
Absolutely. Well, that is, it's not integrity, but it's voting your interest.
Yeah. Business interest.
Your interest trumps safety of others.
Yeah.
I mean, it does seem to me often when we discuss this on the show, people do sometimes like send me these little private messages saying, well, fundamentally, what is at the heart of this conservative, you know, thought process? What is it? Is it greed? What is it? And it seems to me that it's basically, at its heart, it's a selfish project.
Yeah, self-preservation. Their
interests trump everything else. So their profit is more important than the safety features of a tower block. After all, you know, you could always find new tenants. It's not a problem. I've worked in some of these factories, perhaps you have, Dave, where the attitude was very much, you know, if someone loses a finger, so what? There's plenty of other men with 10 fingers.
So, moving on to the Finsbury. Now, this is interesting. Is it a terror attack? Or is it a hate crime? What do you think, Jane?
Do you have a coin?
Well, this is interesting, right? So, go on, sorry.
No, sorry, you carry on.
What I was going to suggest was that I would suggest it's a hate crime, but then you've got various people suggesting it's like a mixture of both or one or the other. You can't have it both ways, I would have thought. Well, we'll get to that. We've got some clips to play that will represent that. But what do you think about it?
Oh, sorry. I'm going to dissent that.
Okay.
Because I said, pass me a coin.
Right.
Now, a coin would either be heads or tails. So yeah. It would go along with your, it's either one or the other. It's an apple or an orange. actually, a coin wouldn't be the best thing because I do believe that it's possible for there to be kind of elements of both present. Mm-hmm. Although I'm now going to sort of discuss what I believe the Finsbury Park attack should be categorized as. Now, the reason I mentioned it could be both is because the Muslim Council of Great Britain, they want to call it both.
Yeah.
For example, they call it a terror attack in quotes, and then they also refer to it as a hate crime and reference Islamophobia.
Hmm. Yeah.
Now, to me, I would say the gentleman concerned driving the van involved in this collision seems that his target of choice was Muslim men.
Yep.
Outside a mosque, a well-known mosque. Also, when liberated from his vehicle, he indulged in some public oratory wherein he expressed his wish that all the Muslims should be killed.
Yeah.
When you put all those things together, for me, it becomes difficult to argue that it's not a hate crime.
Yeah. Right. So let me just play a BBC report. There's a couple, actually, I'll play quickly. Just so we set out.
Focus, this white van rented in Wales. It had turned off the main Seven Sisters Road into a cul-de-sac, hitting the worshippers as it went through. Some of them had been treating a man who was apparently suffering from a heart attack. He later died. It's unclear if he was hit by the van. Either way, he was the only person who died here last night.
So, there's a thing about what you suggested to me the other day. The various TV companies were... The terminology they were using, hit by a van. This is another.
It was just after midnight in London and the third attack using a vehicle in just 3 months. This time, the Muslim community was the target.
Basically drove on the pavement, coming straight towards all the Muslims, and as he's coming to them, he hit all of them.
After the van had crashed through worshippers marking the holy month of Ramadan, leaving 8 badly injured, men who'd been to late-night prayers found themselves wrestling the suspected van driver to the road.
When he was on the ground, I asked him, you know, why did he do that? Why? You know, innocent people. He goes, I want to kill Muslims.
The 47-year-old suspect is believed to be Darren Osborne, a father of 4 from Cardiff, a man unknown to MI5, but somebody who police are now investigating for any extremist or racist views he may have expressed in the past.
Oh, I mean, that's a break from the norm, isn't it? The fact that the MI5 doesn't know him.
Yeah, that's true. They might not be keeping so many tabs on these white members of the population as they are. Enthusiastically either recruiting or monitoring Muslims yeah. who are living in the UK. Now, to return to your question about the terror versus hate crime, well, yeah. why does it matter? Now, for a section of the liberal left, they're adamant that there's a double standard at work and that whenever the attacker is brown, it's immediately a terror attack. And whenever the attacker is white, you know, they're called like a mentally ill person, for example. It's not cited as a terror attack. And so one part of the liberal left reaction is to demand, you know, that this double standard end. Now, actually, I was looking at this a little more closely and taking some pointers from some journalists that are involved in this kind of reporting. Now, one journalist points out, and I'll place this on Book Armour, he said that there is a notable difference between, for example, the Thomas Mayer attack on Joe Cox or this attack here, and that is that the attacker, the perpetrator, shall we call them, is alive.
Yeah.
And has been apprehended. Now, what that means for the newspapers is that they have a different set of guidelines that they have to abide by because this gentleman has not yet been prosecuted or even charged. And so they can't call him a terrorist. They can't necessarily call it a terror attack because a gentleman is going to now be processed by the police and then by the courts. So they can't even say that he deliberately hit the people with his vehicle. So we find there, as you pointed out, the passive, I'm an English teacher, they have the passive voice being used. You know, the worshippers were hit by a vehicle.
Yeah.
They don't signal that the driver intended to hit them. You also see that the correct term is actually a collision.
Right. But they don't even use that.
Sorry, Dave.
I was going to say, but they don't even use that.
Yeah, well, actually, the BBC one there that you played second kind of stepped outside there because they did say attack. Right. Now, the reason they can potentially say attack is because they also there had the quote saying that he's an eyewitness saying that he said, I want to kill Muslims. Yeah. So on that basis, then they may feel that their lawyer will say or their lawyers, it's all right to call it an attack because we have that piece of evidence there from the eyewitness. That, I think that would be the thinking there. In the first one you played, they did not have that quote. And so they were more kept circumspect in the way they reported it. So actually, personally, I'm going to go on a little more why I don't think there's a double standard at work.
Okay.
Now, so should we choose another attack, for example? Because the reason I would not call this terrorism is because I can't see that there's any, I can't see what political... change or political cause would be kind of being advocated here. I can't see that it's going to lead or could even, you can't even suggest that it's going to lead to some kind of political change. The attacks such as the one in Manchester or the one in London Bridge, the Westminster Bridge attack on Parliament is slightly different. But the idea there is that, you know, these guys have these links to the Middle East and their links to these jihadist groups, and the reason they carry out their attacks is because they are seeking either retribution for deaths of Muslims in the Middle East, or as part of, they have a kind of program that they wish to sway the public or to change the government's policies. So the political dimensions are fairly clear to see there. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's I mean, it's the point you raised about the fact that the guy is still alive and the languages that or the terminology that they use has to reflect that. I mean, that's an interesting point because we're very rarely in this situation where the guy is still alive.
Yeah, when it's a white attacker, they don't tend to martyr themselves. Again, this idea of either fighting until you die, as in the Borough Market attack, or the Westminster Bridge attack, or simply detonating yourself, as in the Manchester attack, martyrdom is seen as being a dimension of Islamic terrorism. So that is one of the reasons why, if you have that kind of fight till you die approach, you'll tend to be bracketed as being a terror attack. And also, just the point to divide, as we said here, that after someone's died, the newspapers can say whatever they want. They can call you whatever they want. They don't need to be careful in their reporting. The interesting thing about the Westminster Bridge attack is it's been referred to widely as a terror attack, and yet actually there I would potentially question the basis on which it was categorized as such, because the Metropolitan Police have admitted that the actual motivations of that man may never be known.
So that
would work against the idea of being able to establish that it was being undertaken for political reasons. He could just have simply been, you know, unhinged in some way, or, you know, he was mentally ill, and then this kind of online Islamic stuff. We've all seen the way crazy people, white people, will embrace Christianity inside the, and then find themselves in the loony bin in a similar way. Just because he's got some ISIS videos on his YouTube account doesn't mean that he's a jihadi. Could just mean that he's been drawn into that because of some pre-existing mental condition. We saw with him that he'd already been reported for mental health problems by members of his family. So I think there, it's kind of, to me, it seems kind of doubtful actually whether that should have been counted as a terror attack.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting as well, because there's another common theme that runs through these various attacks, especially in America, where you get the mass shootings. They always seem to be on these antipsychotropic drugs, and one of the side effects of these drugs is suicidal tendencies or thoughts, which is Not the thing you need when you're feeling a little bit low in the first place, I would have thought.
Well, we did see that incident we talked about, didn't we, where the man went to jail because he was he believed wrongly, as it turned out, that a particular MP was going to be responsible for removing the disability allowance that he required. And he had some mental health issues. And so he was terrified about this vote going through and losing his support, which has been a common thread under the Conservatives, is that they have been cutting all of these support services for people with mental health issues. And he sent his threat via the medium of Facebook to the, as it happened, to the wrong MP. But he was arrested by the police, and I believe he was imprisoned in the end. So sometimes there's quite a direct connection between people being destabilized by government policies and then trying to lash out at the people they feel, these people in power who they feel are literally, you know, threatening to destroy the fabric of their lives.
So this is what Theresa May had to say straight after it.
This morning, our country woke to news of another terrorist attack on the streets of our capital city, the second this month, and every bit as sickening as those which have come before. This was an attack on Muslims near their place of worship. And like all terrorism, in whatever form, it shares the same fundamental goal. It seeks to drive us apart and to break the precious bonds of solidarity and citizenship that we share in this country. This morning we have seen a sickening attempt to destroy those freedoms and to break those bonds of citizenship that define our United Kingdom. Because this extremism is every bit as insidious and destructive to our values and our way of life, and we will stop at nothing to defeat it. These are the values that define this city. These are the values that define this country. These are the values that this government will uphold. These are the values that will prevail.
England prevails.
You know, that's where every time she says that, even Amber Rudd started saying that now.
Yeah, good work there with the edit. It's interesting that she did refer to it as a terror attack.
Yes.
As I say, I would disagree with that. The man launching the attack... the people that have been most enthused about his actions are being led by, I don't really want to say his name on the show. All right, we're going to have to say his name, but Tommy Robinson has pushed himself forward as kind of being the poster boy, as they would say, for the Told You So Brigade in terms of... this kind of incident taking place. He posted a Twitter video a while back where he was saying that if the authorities don't do something, and now, of course, a little like Katie Hopkins and the rest of them, whenever they say if the authorities don't do something, they never say what. They never have a prescription. No one has a easy answer, it seems. Not even people as intelligent as Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins. Now, what he was saying and his far right kind of supporters, but actually I would take issue with the idea that they're far right, because it does seem to me that a lot of the reaction is on the level of a sort of English football hooligan kind of reaction. It's basically what a lot of bald-headed white men in pubs believe. That's what it amounts to.
I've met a few,
and
actually,
for these ones, it's like they had jokes on Twitter like, is the van okay, or I wish that he'd, you know, had a better aim and knocked down like 20 more. So they're saying this is payback for these attacks. And actually, if you remember rightly, last month after the Manchester attacks, Katie Hopkins, I've got her quote here.
Yeah, kind of.
After the Manchester attacks, she said, I will quote, "Western men, these are your wives, your daughters, your sons. Stand up, rise up, demand action. Do not carry on as normal, cowed." Now, a month later when this attack happens, Katie Hopkins believes that it's absolutely outrageous to suggest that there's anything at all in her words that might have encouraged gentlemen such as Darren Osborne to take matters into their own hands. You decide. But the interesting thing here is that if we follow Katie Hopkins' logic, then you would assume that after the Finsbury Park attack, I was busy rewriting this tweet. Do you want to hear my new version?
Got it.
Muslim men, these are your brothers, your sons. Stand up, rise up, demand action. Do not carry on as normal, cowed. Instead, Katie Hopkins' message is, perhaps we can find agreement. Surely we can agree the rush to argue or bicker or blame doesn't seem to get us anywhere. Whether we like each other or not is irrelevant. I don't need you to like me for us to be able to agree. That is the very worst kind of relationship. So it's touchy-feely. You know, it's not Muslim men be angry, get out there on the streets and demand action. No, actually, for Katie Hopkins, for Muslim men, it's like, well, just carry on about your business. You know, so there is absolutely hypocrisy at work on the place of Katie Hopkins. And as I say, it just seems to be that for a certain kind of individual, they're satisfied that this attack represents some kind of payback. It's ludicrous because the people killed were not the people that killed those people in Manchester. They were not the London Borough Market attackers or the Westminster Bridge guy. They had nothing to do with it.
That would be the same as when you had the IRA bombing going on. You know, Irish people were, you know, generally still quite safe walking about. No one basically would necessarily point a finger at them as seemingly they're doing in this case. I mean, especially with that Tommy Robinson, he's been saying this allegedly for 10 years that it's coming. There's a war going on and all this kind of stuff. It sounds like Alex Jones.
It's one of these guys who's busy warning us about the thing that actually he would really love to happen.
Yeah, so let's have a quick listen to what Mr. Robinson has to say. If I can find it. There it is.
Sir William Gladstone held this book above his head in Parliament and he said there will never be peace on this earth so long as we have this book. It's a violent and cursed book. Was Sir William Gladstone, who we have statues across our capital city, was he a bigot or an Islamophobe?
See, now, Winston Churchill, you're sounding like a complete
Winston
lunatic.
Churchill, no, I'm quoting previous some of the best leaders in this country.
You're sounding like a bigoted lunatic.
No, I'm not.
So there's that one and then there's this one.
If we don't get this issue dealt with, then the British public will. They will end up taking matters into their own hands. Take Northern Ireland as a prime example. Militias will be set up, and then the UK government will have a problem beyond their wildest dreams. Will only facilitate the creation of a disgruntled and angry population who will end up cleaning out this Islamic problem. The UK government will then have a massive extremist problem.
So, yeah, a massive extremist problem. This is what he's been saying, allegedly.
Absolute nonsense. Yeah. And actually, Tommy Robinson citing there the precedent of the sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland. Guys like Tommy Robinson, the National Front, the BNP, the EDL, they would love the whole of the UK to be like Northern Ireland. That is absolute bread and butter to these guys. They relish the hatred of that sectarian conflict. Tommy Robinson is the kind of guy where no weekend is complete without a chorus of no surrender to the IRA. I mean, for bigoted people, Northern Ireland is their spiritual home. So the idea that Tommy Robinson's going to be the white knight and kind of lead us away from disaster is on its face ludicrous. I've actually got a different angle on this Finsbury Park attack, if you'd like to hear it.
Go on then.
What I believe is that the actual smart thing to do here is to recognise one thing that has not been recognised properly in amongst all the Islamophobia, which, you know, it's not Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins, it's an entire industry that's grown up. But actually, this attack, if it was the aftermath of it, was handled in the right way, it should be the beginning of developing and turning towards making useful the strength of the Muslim community, the Muslim population in the UK, and actually providing some real unity in terms of tackling this problem. We're very lucky, actually, to have the Muslim community in the UK. As we see, for example, with the Grenfell Tower fire, running into the building and helping to save people, there's an enormous amount of good work that's done by Muslims in the UK. They don't drink. They're not the people that are being banged up on a Friday night for fighting in the pubs. You know, generally law-abiding people. They have a clear set of values. I might not necessarily agree, you know, with all their dislike of gay people and some of the issues that there may be about the their sort of attitudes towards the treatment of women.
The same could be said for the DUP, though.
But as I've said on previous shows, you can find wife beaters and people who don't treat women and girls in a decent way. You can find them throughout Britain. They're not confined to the Muslim community by any means.
No.
I'm sure there's a lot of good Muslim men out there in good relationships too. But as I said, if they could actually be harnessed as a resource, they would be the shield against a lot of these problems that are coming, basically not from the UK Muslim population at large, but from the jihadist elements in their midst. The Prevent program has tried to kind of make this work, but as people that have criticized it, Diane Abbott has been a leading critic, it's been kind of double-edged because the Muslim community feels that they're kind of obliged to participate rather than they're being trusted to partner the authorities to tackle this problem. And they feel that there's an untoward amount of suspicion cast in their direction by the authorities. So it hasn't really worked. But as we've seen with the Manchester attack, for example, lots of Muslims in the Muslim community there were trying to alert the authorities to the danger posed by that guy. It's not that every Muslim in the UK is on the side of jihadis, you know? I'm sure that there were very, very few Muslims in the UK that celebrated in any shape or form the deaths of the people in Manchester or the people attacked in London. So Tommy Robinson and his ilk, I feel, are trying to conjure a problem out of thin air. There is actually no problem with the wider Muslim community in Britain. They have just as much interest in weeding out this jihadi, this extremist element. As we've said on previous shows, one, most of these jihadis are known to the authorities. As you pointed out, every time the attackers are Muslim, they're already known.
Yeah, basically.
So the double standard is the way the UK has acted as a safe haven for jihadis, because London, you know, the Londonistan phenomenon. I've also seen another reference this week that it's not that popular, but the French called London Beirut on Thames.
Yeah. I remember when I had a rough time in Nam, Dagenham.
Yeah. You know, so this, the fact that UK foreign policy, beneath the surface, the part that we can't see, has for so many years, for decades, basically since the war in Afghanistan in the 80s, been using jihadis and allowing them to operate freely from the UK. I hadn't noticed this until I did some research for this week's show, but the French have got numerous instances where they're furious with the British because the British were harboring people, Muslims who were planning terror attacks in France. This is sort of going back to the 80s and 90s. So this is actually the part that I would like to see tackled, is the government lose this double standard. Stop having these people here to begin with. They know who they are, and they should all be returned to their places of origin instead of being allowed to establish these cells all over the country and then the British public kind of bearing the brunt when they decide to deploy their jihadi skills in this way. Many of these jihadis, if you look, the ones that were in Syria, they were trained by ex-SAS officers. So that gives you an idea of the amount of money and the amount of, you know, the level of the investment in these individuals. You know, I've had friends who are in the regular armed forces, and they would tell you, you know, the SAS don't waste any time on anyone down the ranks. You know, you will not get to meet them or share any of their knowledge. You know, that's an elite proposition. So the fact that that kind of knowledge and skills are being imparted to these jihadists in these Syrian training camps, that's a significant investment in these guys. And then it blows up in our faces quite literally when they return to Britain and decide to unleash their skills on the British public. The dots have not been successfully joined. You do see that people in the public domain do kind of link the terror attack in Manchester with events in the Middle East, but they don't see quite clearly enough the way the British government is involved on both fronts. That's the key part to me.
So at the beginning of this conversation, we suggested that, was it hate crime or was it terrorism? Did you come across the definitions for hate crime and terrorism?
I did look up the definitions. And if you read the definition, and if you've got them there, you can read them out. Clearly, the Finsbury Park attack is a hate crime.
Well,
just as the murder of Stephen Lawrence was a hate crime, the murder of Joe Cox was not a hate crime because Thomas Mayer had his extremist ideology and killed her basically because of not wanting Brexit to happen. So that was politically motivated. So he was tried as a terrorist.
I mean, interesting that you mentioned Joe Cox. There was a Guardian article on Finsbury Park attack, "Terrorism Will Not Divide Us." And it states the Finsbury Park attack was all the more terrible for coming when it did after a weekend when thousands of people had attended Great Get Together events in memory of Joe Cox, the MP murdered a year ago. And of course, we've seen her husband doing the rounds. What do you do? I mean, anyway, so just as a sideline. So this
I
is
have
the...
to be honest. Oh, sorry, I have to be honest. I've really got no time for Brendan Cox. If everyone's due their 15 minutes of fame, he's ran out long ago. And this idea that Joe Cox is kind of going to be like this kind of Lady Di figure in death and unite the nation. Joe Cox, as I've said previously, you know, I would not have wished any harm to her. And it was a disgusting and disgraceful act on the part of Thomas Mayer, and he'll rightly never see the light of day again. But this canonization project that Brendan Cox is leading, and the way he's become this sort of talking head every time there's a terror attack, here's Brendan Cox in The Guardian with his opinion again. I'm just finding it a little hard to swallow. And I did feel that this week he was rather self-serving with the way that, even with the Grenfell Tower fire tragedy unfolding, which, after all, let's remember, sometimes it is a numbers game. There was only one Joe Cox, but there were hundreds of people inside that tower block.
Yeah.
I did feel Brendan Cox was rather self-serving, the way he tried to pull the spotlight, some of it, and shine it on himself and his cause this week. I think it would have been a good week just to fall silent, whether he'd planned all his events or not. You know, he could have waited a week. No, he wasn't content. So he's overexposed for my tastes. I did mention to you that I would lock him and Tommy Robinson in a box and just fire it off into space. I don't think we'd be that much worse off, actually. We might even be in credit.
Bargains to be found everywhere. Right, so...
go on.
And I was going to just move on to the definition of hate crime. What was it you were going to say?
Oh, I was just going to introduce the movie reference for this week, which would be Superman 2, where the criminals from the home planet of Superman, at the start, they're being tried in that special court, and you see all those kind of worthy holograms intoning the verdict there. So I don't know if you can put an echo on my voice, but it just we find you guilty, 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 guilty. And then they put these three miscreants into this kind of magic mirror and makes them all flat, and they're kind of screaming, and then they fire the magic mirror off into space where they will be imprisoned until the end of time. Unfortunately, Superman is busy saving the Earth from nuclear catastrophe, and he throws a nuclear warhead out into the solar system, and the shockwave, when it detonates, breaks the mirror, and the three bad people fly out and then return to Earth. Well, the mirror part, the flat 2D thing, that's what I would put Brendan Cox and Tommy Robinson in.
Right. Okay, so hate crime is defined as any criminal offence which is perceived by the victim or any other person to be motivated by hostility or prejudice towards someone based on personal characteristics. There are five centrally monitored strands of hate crime. So these, I think most people would be familiar with these. Race or ethnicity. I can't even say it. Ethnicity, religion or beliefs, sexual orientation, disability, and transgendered identity. I only thought that was a recent addition, but there you go. So, we have some stats. I did a little bit of looking into the figures for hate crime reported last year, so 2015 to 2016, and these numbers would have been compiled by October last year, so they're not... Obviously, the next set of numbers will be out in the next few months. But last year... Sorry, Jay.
Dave, I regret to inform you there, if you can hear my voice, that you're breaking up, and I didn't really catch any of that. So I'm sorry, there's like a technical issue in play.
Oh, right, okay. Well, I can hear myself, okay.
It may be a wonderful moment to have a musical interlude for the week.
And what was that? Hang on, let me see if I can find something to play quickly. Let me sort out the problems. Anyways. That'll do.
Get that Bross album on.
Bross? This is for our friends in safe spaces. Back shortly.
Blame it all on our roots. We never wore boots. Never once played in the street. We feel very bitter. We get our news off of Twitter. And just can't handle defeat. You saw the surprise and fear in our eyes when Donald became president. Screamed, this can't be true. America's through. Into the same spaces we went. I've got friends in safe spaces. If you don't go with us, then you must be racist. That's our catchphrase. Where's my latte? Come on in and let's get cozy. Showing off participation trophies. Watching CNN. Safe spaces. Sing happy songs and watch movies by Michael Moore. We hate the alt-right. We got puppies on sight and we lay around on the floor. There's color in books and sad long-faced looks and tears just explode from our face. But give us an hour. We're delicate flowers. We just need an embrace. I've got friends in safe spaces. Oh, don't go with us, then you must be racist. That's our catchphrase. Where's my latte? Come on in and let's get cozy. Showing up participation trophy. Watching CNN in safe spaces. I got friends in safe spaces. If you don't go with us, then you must be racist. That's our catchphrase. Where's my latte? Come on in and let's get cozy. Showing off participation trophies, watching CNN.
I prefer Fox News.
In safe spaces. You can all come in. Our safe spaces.
Just hold me, Chad. Just cuddle, we need to cuddle.
Lovely. Lovely. So, how's that, Jay? Can you hear me better?
Loud and clear, David. I believe it was some kind of issue with the Skype call itself. Thank you.
Okay. So, where were we? Oh, yes. Hate crime. So...
hate crime. You're going to say about the terror definition.
Right. Oh, I've not got that. Have you got that?
No, basically it's about an act of violence undertaken to further some political cause or changing government policy.
Right, okay. So with hate crimes, there were 62,518. That's a 19% increase on the year beforehand, which was around about 52,000. Now, I had a look at these figures, and it breaks down in these five main strands that I mentioned before, the race, sexual identity and disability and religious. It has here top one at 49,000 out of the 62,000 is race hate crimes. Second is sexual orientation hate crimes. Third is religious hate crimes. I would have thought religious hate crimes would have been higher, but you know. Disability hate crimes, and interestingly, transgendered hate crimes comes in at 1%. We'll be mentioning that.
Well, where are the hate crimes against Muslims being filed? Are they being filed on your race hate, or are they being filed on the religious side?
Well, this is the thing. You see, this is what I found, is that race or ethnicity, that would rule out religious, then, wouldn't it? That would be just down to the race. So I don't know where. Well, yeah, it could be under both, couldn't it? But then, see, the religious hate crimes is only 7%, whereas race hate crime is 79%. So there's quite a difference between the two.
I think you do run into this issue that sometimes, for example, you'll have a victim who doesn't actually belong to the group that the person seeking to attack has targeted. So you'll have a situation where there may be someone who's just from India, he's not a Muslim at all, but he's being targeted as a Muslim. So someone beats him up shouting, you know, crap on you and your prophet, but actually, you know, they're wasting their time. So you can kind of run into this scenario. And I think also for a lot of simple-minded people that are conducting these attacks, the two are seen as kind of interchangeable, aren't they? You know, Muslim, brown person, Muslim. That's the way it seems to work in the tiny mind.
Yeah, you see, there was a couple of tweets that I came across that was making certain observations while they were watching the news shortly after. I do believe that the police officers thought it was like a you're running a mill car accident, which is why they may not have been quite as sharpish to respond as maybe some would have liked. But one tweet in particular said, I can't believe there's so much terrorism. Oh, wait, he's white. I can't believe there's so much mental illness in London. So,
yeah, that's just taking that kind of double standard argument. As we've seen before, there's not a clear line you can draw between, people who have been, so-called extremists and people with, some kind of problems in their lives. You know, necessarily for people who are breaking down or fragmenting, they are ripe for being drawn into these kinds of issues. From what we can see, the background to this Darren Osborne is, you know, he's not a great success. He's not a very popular guy. He's been disowned by his mother now. But you see that there's this kind of, what could we call it, chaotic background. And that's not controversial to say that. I don't know why people want to sort of make it sound as if it's they're being exonerated because they're being called mentally ill rather than terrorists. As I said, I actually just think we should apply the mentally ill thing more to these cases, because it does seem, as you said, in the US, to medications seem to be a common thread in the kinds of people that launch these attacks. And as we've seen in the UK, the Westminster Bridge guy certainly had mental health issues. And Darren Osborne, just because he hasn't necessarily been diagnosed by an NHS doctor, doesn't mean he also doesn't have some of these issues. This idea that it's being used to kind of forgive these white attackers, I just don't really know what point they're trying to hammer home. I think one problem, is, of course, as well, is that when you have an attack such as the one in Manchester, where the guy is involved, you know, quite directly in jihadi activities, it's easy to see what's behind it. Whereas it's not as if this Darren Osborne represents any kind of group. You know, he's not part of anything. There isn't a kind of Christian equivalent of ISIS at work in the UK. You know, that you can point to in the same way. I was thinking about this. What if the Muslim community wanted revenge for this Finsbury Park attack? Who would they take revenge on? You know, there isn't an organized resistance. Maybe they could go and blow up the EDL headquarters. Tommy Robinson seems to live most of his life on Twitter. I haven't worked out yet if there's a way to drive a van into a Twitter account. That could be looked at. But you take my point, right? It's not as if Christian churches in the UK are mobilizing these kinds of attacks on Muslims. It's not this kind of conflict. It's simply just some kind of, to me, like I said, the most obvious reference point is just kind of the football hooligan kind of mentality that I'm kind of familiar with from my own experience following football and the England team. He just seems to be one of these kinds of guys. You know, it's as simple as payback. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that.
So you mentioned the Muslim Council of Britain earlier on. So there's been a few people that I've come across from that organisation. Quickly, the Muslim Council, on its website, it says that the Muslim Council of Britain is a non-sectarian body working for the common good without interfering in displacing or isolating any existing Muslim work in the community. So we've got a couple of guys. We've got one called Migdad Versailles, who's basically turned around and said that you know, it's a hate crime rather than terrorism. So this is what he says.
If I can find it. Yeah. The rise in hate crime against Muslims is a reality that has been underreported, underunderstood, and not really dealt with in the same way as bigotry against other communities. I think that this is a transformative moment where hopefully this will mean that action will be taken to tackle hate crime, and the rise in hate crime against Muslims that has been taking place over the last few years and that really has seemed to have reached a really worrying situation yesterday.
And as with all shock.
Oh, and we have another chap called Harun Khan, who's basically saying the same thing, that over the past weeks and months, Muslims have endured many years incidents of Islamophobia, and this is the most violent manifestation yet. So this kind of, there's a theme here that basically people are all saying the same thing. Even the you know, the mayor's office has come out and said it's a 40% increase in racist incidents in the capital and a fivefold increase in anti-Muslim incidents. So there's, you know, there seems to be a lot. In fact, there's a chap called Fayez Mughal. He's a founder of an organization called Tell Mama. He was actually at that Frindsbury Park mosque 3 days before the incident to suggest to be wary and to look out for possible terror attacks. That was 3 days before the actual attack happened. So someone had some foresight.
Well, I don't necessarily think you need foresight. I think for some people listening, they find it hard to square the idea that Muslims themselves see themselves as victims. Because from the kind of non-Muslim population's view, many of them, they seem to think, well, Muslims perpetrate the attacks, and generally, maybe some Muslims will die in the attacks. I'm not sure if any actually did die in the Manchester attack or in those other attacks. But they struggle with the idea that the Muslim population at large feels themselves actually under pressure and to be to have a genuine case to be the real victims of the backlash that these attacks engender. Whereas I do have sympathy for them because there's a very large Muslim community, Muslim population in Britain. It's literally a few individuals that are perpetrating these attacks, and yet Muslims at large are bearing this kind of backlash. Maybe some of it is just simply insults or verbal kind of abuse, but it may be running up to more than that in some of these incidents. So I remember when let me take another view on this. Remember when the News of the World, when Rebecca Brooks as it was then, was in charge, she ran that she ran those names of paedophiles in the News of the World, these sex offenders,
right?
And the public went out with these pictures in their hands and these names and began attacking the various addresses or people that look like these paedophiles. And of course, famously, a paediatrician's house was spray painted with all kinds of vile abuse, because, you know, the kinds of people that go and try and lynch people or indulge in mob justice, they're not usually got the best reading skills. Now, that was only over the course of maybe 2 or 3 issues of the News of the World, and that led to quite a large mobilization of the public. Now, the Islamophobia kind of memes, they've been collected this week, like the front covers of the Express and the Mail. Just endless stories about basically the dangers posed by Muslims. So I would believe that you can't, it's not easy to make trace a direct link, but you certainly have to question whether or not the endless right-wing tabloid assault on Muslims and basically lumping them all together in a very reductive way. For the simple-minded elements, reading that kind of trash, maybe just a fraction of them become emboldened, as the Americans like to say, and what you end up with in the end is a Darren Osborne. Of course, all the newspapers that print this filth can wash their hands of it. Katie Hopkins doesn't feel she bears any responsibility. Richard Littlejohn's not losing any sleep. But the atmosphere is definitely created. On my Facebook, for example, people that I would generally believe to be fairly decent people, they do occasionally kind of shock me with when they reprint that kind of trash and spread it around as a meme, these kind of anti-Muslim, to me, Islamophobic sentiments. I certainly think the media coverage is playing its part.
Definitely. Oh, definitely. You know, we've mentioned this Telmama, which is an acronym for Measuring Anti-Muslim Attacks. It's an independent body that seemingly works at, like, policy level with the government. So it has, you know, some influence. So we've got that organisation, and then we've got the Muslim Council of Britain. And they're saying consistently that Islamophobia and these Muslim attacks are on the increase. And we've just looked at the stats, and even they kind of reflect that. So, where do you think this is all going to lead to, then, Joe? Is it going to be blood and war on the streets, is it?
I don't believe it will be war on the streets, no. Although there are certain individuals and
that would like that,
extremist segments of society that would kind of welcome that.
Yeah.
I think, generally, the people in Britain, whether they're Muslims, whatever faith they belong to or no faith, how many people truly have an appetite to wage war on British streets?
Not many.
So.
Yeah.
Most of the time, people just want to live their lives and watch TV and raise their families and, you know, speak to their friends on social media. I don't see the people generally who have this kind of appetite. As I said, a very firm line has to be drawn between a jihadist and a Muslim. Just because a few Muslims are jihadists doesn't mean that all jihadists, you know, that every Muslim is a jihadist by any means.
Yeah.
And Muslims have been kind of instrumental in turning these people in.
Well, you know, especially when you're looking at the Grenfell fire and how that community and even some of the media types that have been on site doing their reporting have even commented on the absolute community spirit of everyone pulling together.
I'm losing you again, Dave.
That's got to be Skype again, isn't it? Right, okay. I'll put on a tune, see if we can do a quick callback, and we'll go from there. Oh, hang on, wrong one. I always do the same thing. New child, Mr. Max, certified to make your ride start looming to the back. Call me Iceberg, bound to get a billion in a second. More bread, I stay fed, a freak, so I'm set. Solo flexing in my section, Harlem world, real protection. Brain infection, I'm reflecting to the players, learn a lesson. Here's a blessing, I'm attesting. New child, Cherie Session, uncut to your gut, the great uptown connection. The first jam was real cool, yeah, help me blow. Now it's time for a part two, so set it off, get funkified. Oh yeah, it's all good. Oh god, I'm sorry, I just had to stop that music.
Right. That was terrible music.
Do you know, it was just the closest one.
I did not hear the end of your point there.
Right, yeah. Well, it doesn't matter, it's irrelevant now, and we've moved on. But we were talking about R&B and that stuff actually yesterday, and that's what that was. I hate it.
It is the worst music I've ever heard. Maybe if you've got a car and you're trying to cover over like a problem with the carburetor or something, you might play it loud as you're tooling down the high street, giving the prospective buyer a run through of the car's features. But other than that, I can't see any reason to be listening to it.
If in doubt, put some bass in it. You know what I mean?
Dear me.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on from the music. you're less of a better word. But we got some social justice warrior news, man. We've not had any for a few weeks. So look, even Jeffy's cheering.
That was my Desert Island Discs.
Desert Island Discs, is it? Right, okay.
The production at Night Star playing.
So you'd found one about the Beatles, Jay, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, if we look at this kind of idea about white privilege, is the running theme. Now, for anyone not familiar with this, it's the idea that basically all white people enjoy this thing called white privilege, which means that you're getting a. Have you watched Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Oh, I have indeed. Oh, who hasn't?
Well, white privilege is your golden ticket. It just means that you can progress through life comfortably in a world that is completely adjusted to your every need. And so you'll never struggle to be heard. You'll never struggle to find work. You'll never struggle to be successful because everything in the world works for you. Personally, as someone who's had to travel around the world twice before I can find a job that pays a living wage, I'm not so sure about how much white privilege has been working for me. But that is its basic outline. Now, of course, once you have that idea of the white privilege, well, then you have to find the most kind of bizarrely trivial instances where people get upset and professionally outraged and write their 3,000-word blog about it. So my favorite one I found was this non-white gentleman who I believe is doing a PhD. I'll try not to laugh. And here's one, the title, often you'll find with these is that you can read the title and you don't really need to read the other 3,000 words. His title is, How Can You Not Like the Beatles? So the basic thrust here is that a white friend, I don't know if he actually will designate them a friend or not. He might be wary about that. Mm. That might be a political issue, how to describe a white person. Perhaps he has to call him
he's a Beatles fan, you know,
or a contact, because every white person is basically working for the other side, the white race, and is continually, whether or not, even when they say they're not, you know, that's when they most especially are working for white privilege. So there's another article I've got which is all about how white radicals are actually the people that supposedly work against white privilege. Yeah, they're the most privileged and they're the most dangerous ones, the ones you have to watch the most, which I thought was quite amusing. So his angle here is that a white person said to him one day, you know, do you listen to music? Well, why not listen to the Beatles? And he took umbrage at this and felt basically moved to write a 3,000-word blog about how, as a non-white person, he sort of picked up a few Beatles albums and listened to them. Went back to his friend, and when he didn't offer the kind of ecstatic review of these Beatles long players, his friend was a little bemused, and that bemusement is then the spark that sets burning the towering inferno of his non-white indignation. And so that is what powers this entire article, is how outrageous it is that people should expect you to know who the Beatles are, whereas no one expects you to know who, insert the name of whatever non-white marginal musician you can think of.
Grandmaster Flash. Just the name one.
I think everyone does know who Grandmaster Flash is, just about, but he's probably got one, you know, like some folk singer from Paraguay in the 1920s or something. That would be his, like, gold standard for being, not someone enjoying the white privilege.
Well, you see, you say about you mentioned about the white privilege, and obviously that chap who's just been released from North Korea, who sadly died recently, Warm Beer, which is a crazy name. He came back with brain damage and passed away. Was it in the last week or so? But there was an article that came out suggesting that, you know, this white privilege is obviously not universal, and this is why the guy died. Because, you know, he went over there thinking white privilege was in North Korea, and what an idiot! I mean, it's crazy.
That's kind of heartless, isn't it? to take that kind of view. Although I must admit, when he was pleading for his freedom at his court case in his ridiculous white suit, he looked like a member of Talking Heads. I didn't find it that compelling. And I did actually, I am guilty, I was falling around laughing when he was pleading for his safe release. I do think that if anyone listening can perhaps hear me out here, but if you do wander down to your local Thompson's, or what do they call it, Thomas Cook, if you wander down to your local branch of Thomas Cook, they have all kinds of destinations on offer that you can spend your vacation time exploring. I think you have to ask for some under the counter options to be given the pamphlet on North Korea. So I didn't have too much sympathy with the fact someone ends up in this most awful regime on earth. And I do usually wonder whether or not every American that is in North Korea is a spy of some description, even people that seem to have the kind of limited intelligence of Mr. Wombie. But what on earth are they doing in North Korea if they're not spying? That would be the only possible reason, surely, to go there, unless you're going to suggest that he's got a horrendous sense of direction at work.
And then, I mean, no one really, botulism, wasn't it, that he was supposed to have contracted while in North Korea? And the doctors here or in the States have said, there's no seemingly evidence for that.
Well, I can't vouch for the kind of fare on offer in a North Korean labour camp, although yeah. I have spent a week at Butlin's when I was a child, so I'd imagine that the food on offer is probably superior to that. But yes, the North Korean authorities, I think they were trying to get rid of, it's the opposite. They were violating the pottery barn rule, as they call it, of American politics, which you may be familiar with. It's this: if you break it, you own it. I think they broke it, and they were very quickly handing it off to the Americans before the rot set in too terminally. So they sent him out in a kind of comatose state. And unfortunately for him, he never did wake up. His father appeared in a press conference while Wombie was in his last moments on earth as a living person, and the father saw fit to wear the white jacket, which I didn't think that it's like the opposite of a talisman, that jacket. I thought you would have been instead like thrown it into the nearest furnace. It hasn't brought its previous incumbent any luck.
Yeah, it's you got a problem with Butlins, Jay?
The less said, the better about my dad's choice of holiday destinations when we were children. If I read them out to you, I think the listeners will just shudder as I say each one. Do you want me to give you a few samples?
Gannon, we can compare notes. Gannon, top three.
Okay, Minehead.
Oh yeah.
In the same week that the Scousers were there, so it was, you can imagine how bad that was.
Busy.
Someone tried, one of the Scousers tried to drown my brother in the swimming pool. So that was one of the things that happened. All of our bedding was stolen.
Right.
Another holiday maker hit me on the head with a snooker cue when I was trying to enjoy a sedate game of billiards. Someone stole my brother's tricycle as well. So he spent most of the holiday at it's not really a police officer, but they have their kind of security person, lost property guy on site. We spent most of the holiday stood there crying, filling out forms about all the various indignities and assaults that we'd suffered. But my dad being my dad, I think actually from memory that he took us straight back there the next year.
Well, you see, I went to Butlins at Bognor Regis. And I don't remember it being that bad. But,
I deserve a purple heart for my experience at Butlins. Now, another one was Tenby.
Tenby? That sounds familiar.
Somewhere in Norfolk. And I think Norfolk is the old Anglo-Saxon word for nothing to do. I think that's what Norfolk means. If you translate it, it means flat, nothing to do. Because we spent a week there and literally there was nothing to do.
And it was flat, I take it.
it was extremely flat. My dad's an engineer, so my dad actually was, you know, I think my dad had a spirit level in the car, so he took it out of the boot and started measuring the land, and my dad was, you know, absolutely, you know, thrilled, you know, that the land was perfectly flat. So my dad it's amazing what my dad could find to enjoy on holidays. Whenever we went to stay anywhere, my dad would be tapping the walls and listening and talking about the pipework. So I think that's enough of that horror story of my childhood. Thanks for reminding me of that.
That's all right. You'll be able to think about it later on when you go to sleep. So we've got one more little anecdote, well, story. So this one caught my eye. This was funny. Because, I mean, at one of the comments underneath it, it actually said, this has to be some satire, because what they're trying to tell you in this is, well, it's strange. So the title is, "You're a Bigot If You Wouldn't Have Sex With Your Gay Friend." And what the general point is that the population of the people in, let's say, this country, for instance, is so low. There's such a small percentage of the overall population that basically you should really help out your gay friend, because there could be an opportunity where this guy or woman could go through life without meeting a kindred spirit. And so now we're obliged to help them out a little bit, you know? Bit of "As Your Father." What do you reckon, Jay? Fortunately, you're in Taiwan.
Well, there's that Little Britain, isn't there, with the only gay in the village.
Yeah, that's probably where it comes from, isn't it?
I did find it kind of amusing. One of the things when we discussed this was I suggested that we have to take it to a kind of push it to its logical extreme, which would be a case where the gay friend actually rejected your advances. And in order to prove that you're absolutely not a bigot, you had to rape them. I thought that would be quite a good example. And after you've raped them, you could feel, you know, perfectly satisfied. I mean, even if they sent you to jail, you'd be there rattling your bars, you know, at meal times, and you'd be able to thrill to the fact that although you're serving like 10 years hard time,
at least you're not a bigot.
Shout, "At least I'm not a bigot."
That would be quite funny. I mean, yeah, it's a ridiculous story.
Yeah.
But this is where it's going now, isn't it? This is, it's all... It all seems to be going in the same direction. You know, they say that they give a stat in this article of 3.5% of the population is like LGBTQ plus. I imagine that would be all the other letters that are now being implemented, like I and whatever it is. Loads of them, isn't there? There's too many to keep up with sometimes. So
Why don't they just make it the alphabet, and then it'd be easier to remember?
Yeah, well, unless you want to identify as something else other than a letter in an alphabet.
I don't know. What, as a colour or a smell or a frequency?
Why not?
Something like this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, a frequency. 332, please.
That's what you can only communicate with me on this particular, on my frequency. If you communicate on another frequency, that just shows what a bigot you are.
Right. I think that's, there was one thing that we have missed, but we spoke about it earlier in the week. That America shot out a Russian plane over Syria, which is quite serious.
Well, if we were going to, it was a Russian-made plane, but it was being flown by the Syrian forces.
Right, okay. So actually, America shooting out a Syrian pilot is generally, yeah, that's what they do, isn't it? I suppose that's what you need
to
do.
The interesting thing there was...
Go on.
Sorry.
That's all right.
The interesting thing there is that actually that is potentially a world historical event which has just taken place in terms of where this conflict is going. And yet, there's been... pretty much. I know that the UK media is otherwise occupied this week, but it's amazing how little comment it's generated. The US media, of course, always acting as an arm of their government, declared that this Syrian plane was shot down in self-defense.
Yeah. What I, when I read a little bit about it, it was suggesting that it was attacking what would be classed as the rebels. The rest of us would kind of class them as basically terrorists because they're like our Nusra Front,
Al-Qaeda, ISIL, or ISIS, or Daesh, whatever you want to call them. So they basically shot them out of the sky because actually they were doing the job of killing terrorists, but seemingly those of us who pay for the terrorists, as in the UK and the United States and various other countries throughout Europe, we don't like that. It goes against our plan. But there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. It's potentially too major an event to sort of... I know we did just kind of tack it on to the end of the show. We just wanted to note that it had happened, but maybe we can return to it next week with a more full discussion.
Yeah, well, especially because one of the American spokesmen has gone on record saying he's actually quite surprised how calmly Russia is taking this, which in itself tells you something. It's almost like, damn, they're not reacting how we thought they should.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it? They keep hitting that hornet's nest with a stick, and they just can't seem to get any reaction so far.
Righty. So I think that's
we need a bigger stick.
Yeah, if he's got an oil field attached to it, that'd be great. Yeah. So I think that's the show then, Jay. What do you reckon? Anything else you'd like to bring up?
Not really, other than to thank everyone for listening and hope you enjoyed the show and that we'll see you this same time next week.
Okay. Let's see if I can play something other than R&B. We'd like to thank everyone for listening and enjoy your week and see you next week. Thank you very much.